This is 1A. I'm Jen White. Bicycles surged in popularity at the start of the pandemic when many people were looking to avoid public transportation and get outdoors. But loving cycling isn't new. It's one of the most popular forms of transportation worldwide after walking. And we wanted to know what gets you on the saddle.
My name's Carol. I'm calling from Oklahoma City.
Matt, and I live in Santa Cruz, California.
I ride my bike every day possible.
I think bicycles are the most incredible invention ever.
One, it is good exercise.
I collect them, I ride them, I buy them, I sell them, sometimes I race them.
And two, it's the closest I can get to flying while still being on the ground.
Nothing comes close to the joy, the feeling I have from getting exercise, transporting, flying on wheels.
I love the freedom. I love the wind in my hair. And I love that feeling of forward movement in my life.
Best invention ever.
Carol, Matt, thanks for those messages. And we'll hear many more of your messages this hour. But first, joining us from Brooklyn, New York, is Jody Rosen. He's the author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Jody, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Jen. Great to be here.
So we just heard Carol and Matt compare biking to flying. And that's not just a metaphor. When you ride a bicycle, you're airborne. Explain that for us.
Well, yeah. When you're on a bicycle, you're traveling atop two wheels, which, of course, inside of the tires on that thing is a pneumatic rubber sleeve. It's literally, you're riding on a kind of hoop filled with air. So you're not actually touching. There's no part of the vehicle that you're riding that's actually, touching the ground exactly. It's more like you're resting on air. So metaphorically and in fact, you're flying in that sense. And you certainly, the bicycle imparts that feeling to your body because the way the bicycle bears the weight of your body gives you this sensation. Certainly on the best bike rides, that you're kind of zipping along through the air. You're not quite earthbound. You're sort of in a different zone, somewhere between the sky and the earth. But there's a real history behind this as well, because it's not just, metaphorical or some sort of a physiological fact. It's actually based in history. If we look at the invention of the airplane, look at the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers were, in fact, bicycle mechanics. They were bicycle mechanics and manufacturers, and the kind of crucial innovations they made, the crucial kind of insights that they came to in the development of their first airplane, the Wright Flyer, were because of their work as bicycle mechanics. They used bicycle parts straight out of their bicycle workshop to create the airplane and to conduct the experiments which led to the development of that Wright Flyer. And they recognized that, like a bicycle, an airplane could be an inherently unstable mechanism which depended on the kind of bicycle, the pilot manipulating the plane in the same way that a cyclist does when he or she makes little corrections all the time to kind of keep the bicycle moving forward and upright. So there's been this long history of the idea of the bicycle as a flying machine. We've seen it in advertising posters in the late 19th century, these images of bicycles as kind of spaceships zipping through the Milky Way. And it's definitely, as your callers mentioned, something that you really do feel when you're out on a really good bike ride.
So is it just about that feeling of flying through the air, the wind in your hair, that gives us that connection between flight and riding a bike? Or is there another reason they're sort of intertwined in our collective consciousness?
Yeah, I think it's because of the larger feeling of kind of autonomy, freedom that you experience on a bike. You can't move faster across the land under your own power on using any other means than a bicycle. On a bicycle, you move four times faster than you do when you're on foot, and you do it expending five times less energy. So it's an incredibly one of your callers called it the greatest invention. It's certainly one of the greatest, I'd say. It's a remarkably well-engineered machine that kind of that works extremely efficiently to kind of supercharge your speed and movement across the land. And in this sense, I think that's part of the connection. There's also just the history of, you know, before a bicycle came along, the way people moved around was either on foot or, you know, using a draft animal, hitching up a horse or a donkey or a dog to some sort of cart and pulling them along. Well, now you had something where you were sort of merging your body with this machine. You were becoming, in effect, a kind of a component of the bicycle. You know, the bike rider is both the passenger on a bicycle and the engine. And I think that incredible feeling of power and individual freedom, the ability to go where you want under your own power, quickly or slowly, if you prefer, contributes to this kind of flying sensation, because it's not a feeling you can get when you're driving a car or, you know, a passenger on a bus or a train.
Now, the bicycle dates back to 1817. Who invented it?
It was invented the year before, kind of, I guess 1817 was when the first bicycle was unveiled, but it was sort of around 1816, 1817 that a guy named Carl von Dreis, who was a minor German nobleman in the Duchy of Baden, in what was then the German Federation, came up with this idea to design a vehicle which, instead of putting, you know, your wheels along an axle on either side of the vehicle, he had this really eccentric insight at the time to line the two wheels up in a row, one in front of the other, and create a vehicle that you kind of straddle as you would a horse, balance your weight across, and, you know, move down the road. That first bicycle, the one that that Carl von Dreis invented in 1817, he called it the Laufmaschine, which means the running machine. The reason he called it that is you literally kind of like straddled your put your body weight across it and ran. It didn't have pedals, so it was a push bike. It was a bike that you scooted down the road with a kind of ice skating motion. You kind of scooted your feet against the pavement to propel it forward. Mm-hmm. A little bit like those, in fact, a lot like those balance bicycles that you see children using to learn to ride as a sort of starter bike these days, those little wooden machines that also lack pedals.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of, you know, it wasn't exactly a bicycle in the sense that we have a bicycle today because it crucially lacked these pedals, but it was definitely the very first bicycle-like device that was ever invented, and it launched the age of the bicycle.
We're talking to Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And we're also talking to you. Here's Mark in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I have a most unusual bicycle. It carries a real piano on it. It weighs 625 pounds with the piano on it. And we've ridden the bicycle 3,400 miles in different regions of the U.S. in order to promote kids' access to arts and athletic. And I just want to say that it's been a thrill of a lifetime for myself to be able to ride this unique contraption and surprise people with gifts of joy.
Mark calls his bike Mr. B's Joybox Express, and he told us he likes to ride around Ann Arbor and Detroit and joy bomb people on the streets. We're tweeting out a photo of his piano bike at our Twitter, at 1A. Mark, thanks for that message. Jody, so many people associate bicycles with joy and freedom, but you call your book a tough love history of the bicycle. What are some of the complexities in the history of how bicycles have been used?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about bicycles is a lot of the rhetoric that surrounds them, particularly among bicycle enthusiasts, bicycle advocates and activists, kind of picture the bike as this noble and ennobling device, as this wonderful kind of green machine that has a lower, you know, next to zero carbon footprint, that is good for the planet, good for cities, good for your health, and possibly even a redemptive or messianic device, something that can save the world. There's a lot of rhetoric around the bicycle that makes that case. And I don't want to poo-poo any of that. I love bikes too, and they are wonderful machines that can do a lot of good for this world and especially for the cities we live in. But that sort of rhetoric is complicated by the actual history. When you look at the history, some of the pieties around the bicycle is this good thing over against the bad car. Are challenged. So, So if you look at the way that the bicycle arrived in many places in the world, it first arrived ridden by soldiers and by missionaries or prospectors or other people who were kind of impinging on indigenous lands in the age of empire. This is true in Africa. Lots of colonial agents in you know, European colonies used the bicycle both to get around, but also to wage wars of conquest. So we have to kind of look at that picture also. There's an extremely dark chapter in the bicycle's history. If you look specifically at Congo, at the Congo Free State, that is the colony that King Leopold II of Belgium established in the Congo in the latter part of the 19th century.
There, you know what, Jody, let's pause here briefly. We're talking to Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. After the break, we'll get into some more of the complexity of the history of the bicycle. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking to author Jody Rosen about his new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. If you want to weigh in with your favorite bike memory or what gets you in the saddle, tweet us at 1A or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Now, Jody, you were explaining this surge in popularity bikes had in the 1890s, and that meant a sharp rise in demand for rubber. King Leopold II of Belgium sought to meet and profit off that demand. Walk us through what happened.
Right. So I was saying that that there was this just tremendous boom, bicycle boom in the middle part of the 1880s into the 1890s through to the turn of the century. And this, as you say, increased the demand for rubber, for the pneumatic tires in the bicycles. And King Leopold II instituted a regime of forced labor, really in slave labor, in his colony in Belgian Congo. Historians estimate that somewhere between 10 to 20 million Congolese Africans died in that brutal regime. So we have the bicycle, implicated in this horrific humanitarian and ecological catastrophe. So my larger point was simply that if you look at the history of the bicycle, just like if you look at the history of any machine in this world, it's not only a noble and ennobling tale. There are these complexities. We see these continuing today because on the one hand, you know, bicycles, as I say, are very good for cities and are great for public health and for the environment. On the other hand, scholars have shown, academics, policymakers, people who study these things have shown that, for instance, bicycle paths are often correlated with gentrification and the predations of real estate developers. So there are complications along the lines of class and race in our cities today in which the bicycle is likewise implicated. So it's a muddy picture, as it is with any real thing in the real world. And that, I tried to bring some of that perspective in my book on the bike.
Well, I want to stay with this surge in popularity in the 1890s around bicycles, because while they were popular, many of the time also questioned their value for society. Here's a newspaper excerpt from 1897. This is from the Montana newspaper, the Anaconda Standard.
The bicycle is a menace to the mind. It annihilates the reading habit. The reading rooms and libraries, as compared to what they used to be, are deserted. It is a menace to the health. It provokes heart disease, kidney affections, consumption, and all sorts of nervous disorders. It is a menace to the domestic virtues. It breaks up and destroys the home. The children are turned into the street or left at home to look out for themselves while father and mother go spinning. It is a menace to morality. It makes women immodest. And when a woman throws off the beautiful reserve which the Almighty has placed around her, she stands on dangerous ground. There is no telling what a woman will do after she has lost her womanliness. The bicycle opens the way for everlasting ruin to a multitude of young men and women who might otherwise escape.
And again, that's an excerpt from a newspaper written in 1897. And thanks to 1A producer Chris Remington for his voice acting work there. Jody, how widespread was the bicycle moral panic at the turn of the century?
Oh, extremely widespread. I mean, the context here is simply that the bicycle itself was so popular in this period and kind of hit the 1890s like a lightning strike. Its effect is comparable. Well, to something like the transformative power of the internet, or you know the way rock and roll or jazz, the sort of social transformations that were engendered by the arrival of the bicycle. So, 1885, that was the year we've got this finally a beautifully engineered modern bike, what was called the safety bicycle at the time because it was safer than earlier models, and suddenly it was not only easy to ride one of these things, but affordable and available to the masses, where earlier bikes were more expensive and were kind of like a status symbol for wealthier people. And so what you had was suddenly millions of people were on bicycles, especially in the United States and Western Europe. And crucially, many people who previously hadn't had access to that kind of personal mobility, who had to walk on foot or take public transportation, suddenly could zip around on bikes. Now, the most importantly, we heard a bit in that excerpt, women took to the bicycle by the millions. And this was viewed as a real threat to the social order, because these women were not only riding these bicycles just to get around town, but it was sort of viewed as a symbol of personal and collective emancipation for women, and was embraced as a tool of protest by suffragists, by feminists who were protesting, advocating greater women's rights, the right to vote. So predictably, as you say, there was this tremendous backlash to this great bicycle mania, a moral panic that we typically see greeting, big new inventions that transform society. So that excerpt is very much not an anomaly. There's lots of stuff like that from the period.
Well, let's go back to our voicemail box, because we got lots of messages from some of you who associate bicycles with independence, liberation, and freedom. Here's Elena in Denver, Colorado.
I learned to ride a bike later in my childhood, and it was such a magical feeling. A few years later, my family became chaotic and felt unsafe, so I rode my bike around my neighborhood a lot as a way to feel safe and free and like I was having fun. When I ride today, it still feels magical and liberating and fun, and is one of the only ways I have to experience those emotions altogether.
Elena, thanks for that message. Susan B. Anthony once said the bicycle, quote, has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world, end quote. Jody, how did bicycles help pave the way for women's rights?
Well, as I was saying earlier, it's women, particularly middle class white women, if we want to get specific, in the period of the 1880s, 1890s. But prior to that, they didn't have the same kind of personal mobility. There wasn't the same sort of autonomy. Women often had to go places chaperoned, and suddenly the bicycle afforded them this new means of getting around, not only quickly under their own power, but alone. They could go where they wanted, unchaperoned. There was also, reforms to what was called the rational dress movement arose as a result of the bicycle. So prior to this period, middle-class women were in this late Victorian period, were wearing these, huge skirts and, constricting corsets and whalebone dresses, which made it very difficult to even move around on foot, let alone do something like mount a bike. So women who wanted to ride bikes suddenly decided to start wearing other kinds of clothing, most famously so-called bloomers, these kind of pantaloons, these big, almost like MC Hammer style pants, right? That they used because they could wear them when they were riding the bike, which again was viewed by kind of guardians of public morality as this grave threat to the way things should be, because you had the new woman, a feminist woman, a liberated woman, moving around on a bike in this crazy modern clothing. So they really were crucial to the women's movement at this period, as that Susan B. Anthony quote illustrates.
When else have bikes symbolized or maybe even facilitated independence through history?
I mean, they have often, bicycles have often been used in protest movements around the globe. And so we see, for instance, just to choose a, you know, a relatively historically recent example, the huge uprising in the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989 in China. That was really a bicycle protest. Hundreds of thousands of people rode on bicycles to Tiananmen Square every day to engage in those protests. Eventually, there were a million people in Tiananmen Square making that protest. And in fact, in the horror of the Tiananmen Square crackdown, whose anniversary we just recently celebrated on June 4th, 1989, you saw bicycles not only crushed by the tanks of the Chinese army during that protest, but people using their bicycles to fight off the tanks and to whisk people, the injured, out of Tiananmen Square. So they really played a crucial role in that movement. But it's been the case, you know, throughout history, most recently even in the 2020 Black Lives Matter uprising. You know, thousands and thousands of Americans took to the streets on bicycles. The bicycle has long been, there was a Chilean politician in the late 1970s who said socialism can only arrive by bicycle. There's this sense that the bicycle is especially a kind of device of the left and of personal and collective liberation. And that, as I say, has been a recurring theme in history.
Well, we asked for your favorite bike memories, and many of you are taking us back to your childhood.
So one day I took my bicycle and I put my stomach on the seat and I put my feet stretched out behind me, my hands on the handlebar, and I was a wizard flying through. I just was in another world. I went down the little hill in front of my house to make a wide turn to go into the school ground, and there was a chain across the entrance of the parking lot. And I just flew across it. My bicycle went from my back over my head.
Me and my friend Colby, he always had his hair combed like James Dean, and he went out and got his father's 46 Cadillac in order to tie it to my Whizzer bicycle, which had a motor on it, and we're trying to get it primed up because it was so cold to get it running, you know. And I just about slid into the Tennessee River on that ice.
When we were growing up, we would take a grocery cart and put it at the bottom of a hill in our neighborhood and jump over the grocery cart, use it for a ramp. If you landed successfully, we would cheer for you. And if you didn't land successfully and crashed and got busted up, we would laugh at you.
Okay, I just feel like we need a little disclaimer here that we do not encourage nor condone any of those antics, but we do appreciate the messages. That was Patricia, Daniel, and Barry. Jody, so many of the stories we're hearing are from childhood, but cycling wasn't always an activity for kids. When did that start?
Yeah, no, originally it was thought that bicycles weren't for kids at all. They were adult, you know, they were personal transport machines, utilitarian machines that you used to get around town, run errands, do your business. It really only caught on as a sort of children's plaything in the United States after the arrival of the automotive era. You know, so when Ford's Model T came along at the end of the first decade of the 20th century, suddenly you had car culture, and bikes were marginalized in American cities and on American roads. And bicycle manufacturers needed to find a new way to market these machines. So they thought, okay, let's aim for the children's market. And then the bicycle was really recast as a toy, and that has been, you know, a kind of an idea that's really stuck with us in American culture through the decades. For better and often for worse. I will say that these stories we're hearing are wonderful. And it is true that, like, that, you know, that moment of when you learn to ride a bike, when the adult who's kind of behind you steadying the bike lets go and you're suddenly moving forward on your own is really an archetypal, like, almost unequaled moment of, you know, in your childhood, where you suddenly feel this sense of your own power and freedom. And I think what's wonderful about the bike is you can kind of have that feeling of like, I'm riding a bike, even as adult. There's no machine which more instantly teleports you back to your childhood than when you're, you know, whizzing down the road on your bike.
We're talking to Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. We're also hearing from you. Tyler tweeted us, I'm a long longtime bike enthusiast, but my wife has a degenerative disease, making balance and coordination very tough. We were able to find a bike where she sits recumbent in front, and we have ridden thousands of miles together. Saved our marriage. And Bex tweeted us, "I love my life behind handlebars. I'm 42 and haven't owned a car in 22 years. I ride my bike to work in Jackson, Wyoming, and have done so previously in Kauai, Nantucket, and in Boston. Co-workers often offer a ride, but I love starting my shift after a meditative ride." Jody, you're a dad, so you've had the experience of teaching your son to ride a bike. We're hearing so many personal stories from listeners about what bikes mean to them, but what do they mean to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the bicycle has been my primary means of transport my entire adult life. And, you know, obviously it was my primary means of transport when I was a kid too, other than walking around. And I really share the feelings that were expressed there in some of these messages. That is, it's just there for me riding a bike. What I noticed about bike riding is that I feel better on a bike than I do off it. On those days when I can't ride around for any reason, if maybe it's raining, it's just not the best way to commute on that day, maybe I've got too long a trip to make and I can't show up, you know, dripping with sweat, I feel almost like an amputee. So part of the reason I wrote this book, you know, which is called Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle, is to probe that mystery, make my own personal investigation about why it is that it feels so good to ride this machine, and why is it that I feel better when I'm kind of merged with the bicycle and I'm like the engine of a bike than I do when I'm walking down the street on two legs. In terms of you know, being the father of a child who rides bikes, I have my older son is now almost 18, and he, like me, zips around New York on a bicycle. It's a little nerve-wracking because he's kind of a daredevil, takes after his dad in that way. But I really don't have the any moral ground to stand on in kind of tisking him about riding around in New York City, because it's my favorite way to get around town too.
Well, we've been talking about using bikes to travel, but not all bikes go somewhere. Let's dip back into our inbox. Here's William in Maynard, Texas.
I was living in Central America for about 10 years, and it was really easy to stay in shape. As soon as I moved to Texas 3 years ago, I put on 60 pounds. Thankfully, I've taken 30 of those off by putting a stationary bike in front of the TV, and I don't sit on the couch. I sit on the bike and pedal when I'm watching a favorite show. I would do it outside, but it's not safe on the roads around here.
William, thanks for that message. Now, we'll talk to a bike activist about road safety shortly. But Jody, briefly, what can you tell us about the history of the stationary bike?
Yeah, the stationary bike is a very interesting curiosity in the history of the bicycle. Some people argue that the stationary bike actually predated the arrival of the bicycle proper, because there was a machine called the Gymnasticon, which was invented in the late 18th century, which is kind of looked like a stationary recumbent bicycle. But yeah, these are machines which not only have been used in the way that your caller uses it to stay in shape, but also as machines to power electrical devices, to conduct experiments. You know, doctors use them for various types of diagnoses. And of course, it's become an especially big deal in recent decades with the arrival first of spinning classes, these kind of, you know, indoor cycling classes that are kind of the bicycle equivalent of step aerobics. And during the period of the pandemic, of course, we saw Peloton's boom. So that's sort of like the stationary bicycle taken into the realm of cyberspace. It is an interesting thing to ride a bicycle that, as I say in the book, goes nowhere fast, that you can ride a bike really fast, but not move forward, not an inch.
We're talking to Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He is also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he's joining us from Brooklyn. In a moment, we'll get into the pandemic-era bike boom and what it means for cyclist safety. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
Gingerbread man, here a man, there a man, lots of gingerbread man. Take a couple if you wish, they're on the dish. You're the kind of girl that fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything, if you want thing.
Let's get back to our conversation with Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And another guest joins us now to explain the issues bike riders face on roads today. Danny Harris is the executive director of Transportation Alternatives. That's a biking, walking, and public transit advocacy organization in New York City. Danny, welcome.
Hi, Jen. Great to be here.
So COVID ushered in a cycling boom. 1 in 10 American adults who hadn't been on a bike in more than a year reported getting back on the saddle. I include myself in that number. Trail ridership tripled in March 2020 over the previous year, and the surge in demand triggered a bike shortage. What did that boom look like in New York City, Danny?
Well, in New York City, it really was transformational. It was building on, you know, decades of advancement in both bike infrastructure and working to break car culture that created an invitation for New Yorkers to move around by bike. You know, the challenge with these things is that, you know, Mayor de Blasio once told New Yorkers, bike or walk if you can. The if you can is the incredibly important piece of this bike boom, because the two biggest reasons that people don't bike, one is because of bike safety, and the second is because of the absence of bike parking. So you had more people accepting the invitation, and you had the city failing to meet the needs of New Yorkers who were accepting the invitation to move around by bike.
So what has that meant for the work you do?
Well, for bike advocates around the country, what we're seeing is really these two trends. One is a tremendous bike boom. And as you mentioned, both in terms of walking into any bike shop or just looking around and seeing more people biking. And on the other hand, you have rising traffic deaths, and especially more people are dying biking. And part of the reason for that is because vehicles are getting so much larger. You know, you look at something like the GMC Hummer EV, and while it may be good for the environment, it's almost 10,000 pounds, and it's actually too heavy to cross the Brooklyn Bridge. So you have this arms race, especially among auto manufacturers, of building larger, more powerful vehicles, and also more people, especially like my children, accepting the invitation to ride around by bike, and the absence of protected bike infrastructure to protect our most vulnerable road users.
Well, we heard from many of you who were also a part of the recent bike boom.
I learned during the pandemic that an hour a day on my bike completely changed my state of mind. Now I try to bike 60, 70 miles a week.
I and my wife biked a little bit before the pandemic, but we really started getting into it. And we found it to be an activity that is wonderful for emotional and physical health, but also something that's really been great at bringing us together, having an activity. One of my concerns about cycling as a family activity, though, is it is kind of cost prohibitive. To get a really good bike can cost several hundred dollars. And then attaching the hitch and rack to my wife's car actually cost us around $500. So it was something that we probably couldn't have done until this point in our life when I had a full-time job.
Thanks for those messages. I'd love to hear both of you respond to what the caller just described. Jody, I'll come to you first. Just how accessible is biking?
Well, you know, again, it really depends on the environment you live in, the kind of infrastructure that's there. So Danny was talking about here in New York City, you know, it's, you know, you can get a bike cheap, right? Bikes are low-cost machines. You can get one for a used bike for $20. The issue is, do you have a safe place to ride the bike? Where are you going to park the bike when you get where you're going? And these concerns are, as Danny mentioned, becoming, you know, greater concerns in this moment where we have a surge in cycling, but we also have increased car, you know, here in New York, for instance, there was also a car boom in the wake of the pandemic. So we've got more and more people on different kinds of vehicles trying to move through dense spaces in our cities, and you know, something's got to give here. Here in New York, there's currently a big controversy over whether we're going to be able to implement congestion pricing, which was passed, but there's holdups. Danny can speak to the bureaucratic issues there. We've got more people now embracing the e-bike, which is really a big a revolutionary new device. These are these motorized bikes with electric motors. So there are more ways for people to seek transportation alternatives these days on two wheels and otherwise, but it really is an issue of infrastructure and safety, and that's something that we have to look to our lawmakers, our elected officials, to help us rectify, or else we're going to have increased problems and increased deaths and injuries.
Danny, what would you say about the accessibility question, both from a cost standpoint, but also from a safety standpoint?
Look, I want to honor the words of the caller and those who do feel that, you know, transportation is cost prohibitive. And when we look around, you know, one of the single biggest indicators of moving people out of generational poverty is commute time. And when you look at New York City in particular, those who have the longest commute time are healthcare workers. And this was a statistic that we knew before the pandemic and is certainly much more relevant now. Now, the average car owner, according to AAA, is spending upwards of $10,000 a year in car-related payments. So I would say that if you live in a community where the only tool that you have to get around to have access to a job, to get your kids to school, to visit your older parents, to go to the supermarket, is a car and to be in crippling debt, then your city has failed you. So the notion for freedom in America, I know we like to think, unfortunately, there are too many people sell the notion of freedom as removing options, is that, you know, real freedom is having options. And yes, you can certainly have a car, and you should be able to have access to a bike and a safe way to get around and access to public transportation. But unfortunately, we live in too much of a zero-sum game where the notion of removing even one parking spot in a neighborhood to provide options, you know, is reason enough in some communities to say, well, we don't want any bike lanes. We don't want any bus lanes. We want nothing that would, you know, would make it slightly more inconvenient for us to move a vehicle around our city.
Well, when I think about infrastructure, Danny, I think beyond bike lanes and bike parking areas, and even to things like the status of the roads. I grew up in the Midwest, and potholes galore, which does not make for safe riding.
Right. Well, I think, you know, that's exactly right. And our fundamental premise, and I believe the fundamental premise for all leaders, should be that streets are for people. Streets should be for people and not for inanimate objects. And when you look at New York City, you know, 75% of our public space, the space between buildings, is devoted to the movement and storage of vehicles. And this is in a city where the minority of households own a car. So when we look at really the streets and who they're for and who they serve, they again need to serve our most vulnerable. They should work for those who are under 8, over 80, those who have limited abilities. And when we do that, when we prioritize options, when we create safe, equitable, affordable, sustainable options, then everybody benefits, including drivers.
Now, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, 932 bicyclists were killed in traffic crashes in 2020. And that was a 9% increase over the year prior. Jody, how has the safety of bicycle riding evolved over its history?
Well, here in the United States, it's been a story of, I would say, a decline and fall, to the extent that, I mean, Danny may want to correct me here, but if you look at the peak, the 1890s bike boom, this is before we had the automobile. There was excellent bicycle infrastructure that was built very quickly in many American cities, notably here in New York. In New York, we had something called the Coney Island Bicycle Path, which was like a grand cycling boulevard, the likes of which has hardly been replicated anywhere in the century plus since. But what we really, what the story is a story of car culture taking over. And that, let's be clear about what that is. It's really been the marginalization of the bicycle, not just as kind of an idea, as a, you know, not just something that has been, you know, construed as more of a toy or a children's thing. They've been literally pushed off the roads because there's simply no room for bicycles in cities, which are environments which are especially, you know, that's where you should be doing something like riding a bike to get around, is in a city. So parking spaces are taking up the room that could be used for bicycles. And this is written into our statutes. The laws privilege car culture too. So it's been a long story of increasingly difficult times for bike riders, even as we've seen millions and millions of cyclists embracing the bicycle and wanting to ride through a number of different bicycle booms that have arisen through the decades.
Well, a study found that streets with protected bike lanes had 90% fewer injuries per mile than those without. How common are bike lanes across the U.S., Jody?
I actually would throw that question to Danny. Danny's the one who's going to have those statistics at his fingertips.
Danny, can you tell us beyond New York how accessible bike lanes are?
Well, look, they're not common enough in any city. I mean, you can look at D.C., where I happily lived for many years, or Portland or San Francisco or Chicago or other cities that, you know, have more density and that are building out bike infrastructure, and none of it is fast enough. You know, really what you're looking at is a minimum grid of how is it that you can get around the city and achieve your basic tasks. And so what we've called for in New York City is that every resident of New York should live within a quarter mile of a protected bike lane, protected bus lane, and also an open street or green space. And I think that when we change the mindset, which is more of how many lanes are there in a city versus, you know, what is the mode shift? How many people are taking a bike every day for their average use? You know, New York is a great city in that we feel that we can't learn from anyone, including ourselves. But, you know, what I'll say, when you look at a place like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, places where biking really works, it's not that they're different. It's just that they realize that humans are lazy and they want to take the easiest way between point A to point B. And if you can make that by bike, people will shift, including when the weather is bad. So that really needs to be the change in our thinking about infrastructure. And no American city has done that well. And let's hope that one American city will step up and really take the lead here.
We're talking to Danny Harris. He's the Executive Director of Transportation Alternatives. That's a biking, walking, and public transit advocacy organization in New York City. Also with us, Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. Beyond the question of car culture, I'm curious to hear, Danny, what debates arise in communities that are looking to put bike lanes in place?
Well, look, part of the challenge of the debate is that it becomes, do you want safety or not, as opposed to your neighborhood needs to be safer, and here are two or three options about how it could be. So you can take a place like Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Atlantic Avenue had 10 fatalities just in the last year. The last year was the deadliest year in New York City in almost a decade. So the point is that when that happens in any city where you already have the data and the tools about how to make conditions safer, the conversation with the community should not be, do you want your neighborhood to be safe or not safe? And then let them vote on that, especially when more people are dying. It should be, we want to make your neighborhood safe. And let's consider the various ways that we can do that. So it might be that this is a neighborhood that also needs additional street trees because it's too hot, or it's a naturally occurring retirement community and you want more places to sit, or some of these other type of amenities that can be built in addition to these safety improvements. And right now we live in a situation where bike advocates, safe streets advocates, are still having to fight trench warfare block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, even when we have the proven tools. And unfortunately, because of the lack of political will at the top and also, understandable pushback at a community, that, we still are not at a place where we think of our bike or public transit network like our roads. It would be unfathomable in any community not to have a road that would take you there. Why don't we think the same way about a sidewalk, a protected bike lane, a bus? I mean, we should be thinking of all these things in tandem.
Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg spoke to the League of American Bicyclists in April. He said money from the infrastructure package would help America more bike friendly.
A big part of expanding the use of bicycling as a means of commuting, as well as just a moral imperative for commuting and recreational bicycling alike, is to make sure that it's safe. And there are proven ways to do it. Often those don't get deployed as much as they could be for lack of funding. We are now in a position to bring that to so many more communities.
Danny, how will this infrastructure package make America more bike friendly?
Well, to Secretary Buttigieg and to Deputy Commissioner Trottenberg, who also came from New York, a huge thank you for that. And, as this is about political will. You could drop millions or billions of dollars in each of our cities. And if you, one, don't have the political leadership that understands this vision of safe systems, of building streets for people, of giving people more options, and is willing to build this in every community. I mean, you look at having lived in D.C. for so many years, remember Georgetown opted out of the metro. And they had incredible resources. Now imagine all the neighborhoods that don't have the resources and were left out. We cannot have a transportation system that works for some and not others, that doesn't connect everybody. So the money is important. We need the political will. We need it to come from the top, not just in the government, but from every single one of our cities to be focused on building streets for people and prioritizing our most vulnerable. Otherwise, it's money that will not get spent well.
You know, Jody, for this hour, we've really been focused on the bicycle's role in the U.S., but you look at it really in more of a global context. And what do you think we need to understand about the bicycle within that larger context?
Well, actually, I think this bears a little bit on that, on the conversation we were just having. You know, the question of safe streets is really, it's important to frame that as an issue of equity, justice. It even connects to the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, these transit issues hit. The roads are worse in communities of color. It's more dangerous to be on a bike in a Black and Latino neighborhood in the United States. And the police, incidentally, ticket cyclists of color at a far greater rate than they do white cyclists. So the reason I bring that up when we're talking about the global question is often the issue of biking is framed as a kind of a lifestyle choice, as something to do with, you know, good quality of life, as you know, maybe a kind of a yuppie pursuit or a bourgeois bohemian choice. But if you look around the world, bicycle is labor, it's livelihood. And in the global south, which is where most of the cyclists and bicyclists are in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, you have millions and millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people making their living riding bikes. And that leads us right back here to the United States, because we have our own underclass of working cyclists. So it's all one big bicycling planet, as I say in the book. And that if we start looking in those terms, maybe some of these policy questions will come into sharper focus.
That's Jody Rosen, author of the new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And Danny Harris, the executive director of Transportation Alternatives. Jody, Danny, thanks for speaking with us. Vex tweeted, unlike car problems, which often require a mechanic and result in a hefty bill, I can inexpensively fix most of my problems on my bike. It also gives me a sense of pride to fix it myself. Today's producer was Avery J.C. Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.
Look at me, just called to say that it's good to be alive in such a small world. I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can...